Today is October 7th, and we have Matthew Ho with us. Welcome back, Matt.
Thank you, Nima.
And let's get started, Matt, with what's going on in the Middle East. We have the anniversary of what has happened last year, considering the conflict between Israelis and Hamas. Since that day, how did the Netanyahu administration achieve any sort of goal that they had in their mind? Do you think right now, because the case of hostages right now is still in the hand of Hamas, and they couldn't bring them back home, and right now they want to send their Israelis to the northern part of Israel. At the same time, they started the war with Hezbollah. How do you see the current face of after 1 year of this conflict? How do you see it?
It's I think a year ago it was unimaginable that this level of activity, particularly in Gaza, would still be occurring. I think maybe we could have speculated that it would have expanded, and I think we probably did. That this war in Gaza, what was to become a genocide, could have and would have broader implications and cause events outside of Israel and Palestine proper. So I think that is in line, you know, certainly not details, and none of us have a crystal ball. But this idea, though, that what is occurring in Gaza, that 100 Palestinians were killed yesterday, that the schools are still being bombed, the healthcare facilities are still under siege, that there is a systematic and deliberate destruction of the Palestinian people in Gaza through all aspects of their society. We could spend the whole hour just talking about how Israel has deliberately and systemically destroyed the society of Gaza in all ways, whether it's the infrastructure, whether it's the culture, you know, killing the poets, the playwrights, the professors, the historians, the cemeteries, the mosques, the churches, so on and so forth, the water pipes, the sewage system, on and on and on. Right? I think the fact that it's still as violent as it is today is astounding. And I don't think any of us would have predicted that. I think most of us probably thought, if we go back, I bet I probably said something along the lines, it'd be done by Christmas, be done by the New Year's, and that would be acceptable to the White House. So it'd be similar to what we saw in 2009 or 2014, just maybe more aggressive, maybe a harsher, more violent, maybe by a month or two longer destruction of Gaza by the Israelis as retaliation for October 7th. But what we have seen has been just the opening, the cause's belly that was offered to the Israelis here has been fully seized upon and utilized by the Israeli government to the fullest extent possible, I think. Fullest extent in the limitations of military affairs, logistics, finance, etc. The expansion of the war into Lebanon, the linking of the war in Lebanon with Hezbollah to the linking of the war in Gaza against the Palestinians and Hamas, clearly done so in the last month or two by the Netanyahu government. The expansion of the war into Iran, it's as we've seen continually throughout the year, the tit for tat, with always the edging up to the line, or is this going to go into a full-blown conflict and the crisis that then ensues? And then, of course, the continuation of the warfare in Syria and Iraq that has devastated those countries for decades. The strikes, whether they've been American or Israeli strikes in those countries, the strikes on American bases in those countries, including the killing of three Americans in Jordan back in January. I mean, all of this. And then we have to factor in Yemen as well, because while certainly the Yemeni people have endured for the last decade a genocide themselves, the Saudis and the Emiratis starved to death 400,000 of them. The Yemenis were the first, I shouldn't say the first, because Hezbollah responded immediately to Israel's attack on Gaza, but the Yemenis certainly were there in force right away. And then by January, you had the American Navy engaging in the largest naval battle, the American Navy since World War II, a battle that they have effectively lost, their mission not successful in terms of opening up the Red Sea to commercial shipping, because about 75%, as far as I know, about 75% of commercial shipping is still avoiding the Red Sea. So it has expanded in ways that I think were predictable, expanded in the ways that were foreseeable, expanded in the ways that I don't know if anyone foresee this, particularly say what's occurring in the Red Sea. You know, so just a massive, voluminous war that has peaked at times in terms of the crisis it has sprouted around the world, but has consistently burned human beings in its furnace for a year now. So stepping back from this and trying to take it all in, whether it begins with the horror of October 7th, where, you know, 1,100 Israelis were killed, about 700 of them civilians, I mean, clear war crime in that sense. But then that what that opens up, what that allows the Israelis to do, the causes belli it gives them. And, you know, in terms of, you asked me about goals being achieved, the Israelis stated the goals of destruction of Hamas, the return of the hostages, right? None of those goals have been achieved. None of those goals will be achieved. Destruction of Hamas, i.e. the destruction of the resistance of an occupied people, is simply impossible. The destruction of or the return of the hostages is possible through negotiations, is possible through talks. 251 men and women and children were taken hostage, and 117 were returned, almost all of them, through talks. And now there's another 100 or so that are still there. The rest are already dead. And of that 100 that are still there hostage-wise, how many are dead? We don't know. But I would wager half at least are dead, maybe more. And then the third aspect that the Israelis put onto this war in terms of metric or an achievable goal is the return of their people, their citizens, their settlers to northern Israel, which is a goal that was just added on to that in the last month by the Netanyahu government. And that, like the return of the hostages, is a measurable goal. Either the hostages are back or they're not. Either the settlers are back in northern Israel or they're not. As long as they're not, as long as their hostages are still in Gaza, as long as the Israeli settlers are still living in hotels in Tel Aviv and in Haifa and other places, then the war continues. And so what you're seeing is this open-ended war by the Israelis because this is their chance. They have been waiting for an opportunity like this to carry out further extensions of the greater Israel project, the Zionist project. And this was their opportunity. They've taken full advantage of that. And I think that's what's to come, this open-ended campaign. I think we'll see southern Lebanon turned into a free fire zone, essentially. Beirut will be punished from time to time. I think maybe it will settle down. I don't know. But it will be continually punished, just as the Palestinians were punished in Gaza. And issue with Iran and other nations, the Israelis, the Americans will try and manage the Israelis on it, but the Israelis see the possibility of getting the war they've long wanted with Iran and having the Americans alongside of them as a real possibility now, particularly once the American elections in November are over, so in less than 30 days. Whether the Israelis hold off until then, who knows? But, I know it's a long response, which I know I always give long responses, but and I appreciate the ability to do so on your program. I tell you what, Neem, I really do appreciate that. But I think that's kind of how I'm viewing things, right now, a year after the attacks on October 7th, and the year after the beginning of this genocide in Gaza.
The other goal, Matt, was the elimination of Hamas. What do we know about Hamas today after 1 year of this conflict?
They just fired rockets back into Israel. So obviously they're not completely destroyed. I mean, go back to March when Israel was talking about, Netanyahu was talking about putting his troops into Rafah. Rafah, at that point, you know, the only city that hadn't been razed by the Israeli army with its ground troops. And this, of course, in March, it's important to remember the context. In March, the American primaries were underway. And Joe Biden was supposed to have sailed through the primaries without really any competition, without any problem. The primaries were supposed to go unnoticed for the Democratic Party. And instead, what happens, you have people in states across the United States not in extremely high numbers, but in significant numbers, numbers that meet will could determine the outcome in November, vote uncommitted or not vote for Joe Biden or not show up at the polls. And that scares the Democrats. And so if people remember back in March, the Netanyahu is insisting they have to go into Rafah. The White House, this is when you see the White House really first start to make any efforts overtly, although we know it's all a charade, or all charade, all farce, at pushing for a ceasefire. But, you know, back in March, Netanyahu's insistence was that 21 of 24 Hamas battalions have been destroyed. You know, and that was 7 months ago now, you know. And the White House and the American press, they dutifully repeated that 21 of 24 Hamas battalions have been destroyed. The war is almost over. They did have to go into Rafah and knock out those last few dead enders. You know, when I say dead enders, I've heard Dick Cheney referring to the Iraqi resistance in 2004 that way, as dead enders. You know what I mean? So this idea that they are going to vanquish Hamas and destroy them and wipe them from existence was, it's ahistorical. There's nothing you can point to where there's any evidence of that, such a thing being able to happen. It's fantastic. It's fabulous. It's imaginary. And, you know, but has sustained an undercurrent, and it drives not just Israeli political, military, media thinking on this, but it also drives American political, media and military thinking on this, as if there is a possibility to eradicate Hamas. When the reality is that Hamas is the symbol, Hamas is the growth, the outcome of resistance. And if it's not Hamas, it will be someone else. It'll be a different organization with a different name, but it will essentially be the same thing. It will be the aspirations of an occupied people to be free. We may not like how Hamas conducts itself. We may realize that what they do oftentimes are war crimes, but we also have to realize that they are exercising the legal right of the Palestinian people to resist occupation. And so to condemn them for their acts is one thing, but to do that without condemning and realizing that their acts of resistance are justified and the occupation is the thing that should be condemned is something that far too many people, nearly most people in the U.S. political media and media military circles have completely it's either they ignore it or they just don't simply get it. One thing I think, let's sum it up, this, I'll leave this too. In the last year, looking back at the American political and media, how the American political and media elite have dealt with this, you see how limited they are, how constrained they are in their own bubble, how they do not understand anything except for the official narrative, which has been the official narrative for decades. So the idea that there could be a legal justification for what Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Fatah and other the Lion's Den and West Bank and other organizations have done to resist occupation, it's just it's as if saying that, you know, you have antlers growing out of your head. You know, it's just impossible. So that's one thing, too, to look back on is to understand just how insulated the American elite are from the reality of the situation, whether it's the actual events on the ground or it's the actual facts, details, whether they be the events or they be something more metaphysical.
And what's so amazing about the Netanyahu administration is how right now the people in Israel are feeling about their security. The security of Israel, at the end of the day, what they're talking about, at least in the Netanyahu administration, they're talking about the security of Israel. For the security of Israel, we are starting a new war, new conflict. How do they benefit from this, Matt, in your opinion? And why Netanyahu is just pushing for more conflicts in order to, and for every conflict, his reason is the security of Israel.
Well, Israel, the average common Israeli member of the Israeli public does not benefit in terms of stability or security wise, does not benefit economically. And overall, they are kept captive in a machine that exists solely on the basis of war, violence, confrontation, a continual tension, right? The instability is what provides the stability for those in power in Israel. So if you go back a year ago, you had mass demonstrations against Benjamin Netanyahu, hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets because he is corrupt. He is a crook. He should be in prison. It's clear. And well, among other things, October 7th comes along at just the right time for him to have a national emergency that alleviates those political issues. Those have resurfaced over the last few months under the banner of the Israelis being upset, rightfully so, about their hostages not being returned. And clearly enough voices from Israel, both inside the government and outside the government, have said that Netanyahu has no concern for the hostages. His government has no concern for the hostages. And he sees them as simply just pawns to continue this war going. Otherwise, they could have had a deal. The Israelis could have had a deal months and months ago. They could have had a deal back in October with Hamas to release the hostages. That is clear as well. The Israelis have said so themselves. The average Israeli is under constant threat. There's this instability, insecurity. They are now entering into what they're now entering into, what's to come with this burgeoning, escalating potential war with Iran and its allies. Iran has sent two warnings to Israel, first in April, a missile and drone strike that was for which 3 days warning was given, and then a strike last week, solely composed of ballistic missiles, that for which they still gave hours of notice. At least 4 or 5 hours of notice were given before that strike. So the Israelis are living under a threat of attack from Iran and its allies, the like of which they've never seen, including going back to 1990, 1991, when Iraq was firing Scud missiles. This threat from Iran and its allies are nothing. It's levels beyond anything Iraq threatened them with 30 some odd years ago. So the Israelis are living underneath that. There is the tension of the war all around them. There is the economic bleeding out of Israel that has been occurring for the last year now, whether it's the foreign investment drying up, internal investment fleeing the country, whether it's tourists not coming. For the first half of 2024, Israel had 1/4 of the tourists that they had in 2023. More than 40,000 businesses have closed. You have an Israeli military that is primarily reservist. So 300,000 Israeli reservists called up. That's about 10% of your working population probably in Israel. I mean, so the effects on this for the Israelis, and then what do they get out of it? Where does it go? It's just open-ended war. You're looking at the Israeli government banking everything on having the Americans back them up, finance them, supply them, provide them with diplomatic cover, as well as provide military assistance as well, such as shooting down, helping to shoot down Iranian and Axis of Resistance missiles, those sorts of things. What they're looking at is essentially maintaining free fire zones, mowing the grass, as it's called, not just in Gaza, but also in southern Lebanon, punishing the Lebanese in Beirut with these massive airstrikes, heaviest of which we've seen in the 21st century. I mean, the Israeli Air Force itself says it's never launched such large airstrikes. Then you have as well the possibility then of this continual tit for tat with Iran and its allies, with some in the Israeli government hoping it escalates into the war that they have wanted. Escalates into the reckoning that they have long wanted, if for no other reason, because I can't believe, even though they cite regime change, the idea of regime change is as impossible without marching a land army into Iran and invading them. So I don't see the Israelis marching their 350,000-man, 400,000-man army through Syria, through Iraq to invade Iran. The fantasy, the great hope is that the United States will repeat the Iraq war, this time in Iran. That's not going to happen. So what the Israeli government wants, of course, is to punish Iran, is to inflict pain onto it. One, as a mean of deterrent, but also the pain, the suffering, the punishment for its own sake. This goes back to the Israeli doctrine, the policy, the Iron Wall, which has been Israeli policy for decades, as well as to a continuation of the Dahiya doctrine, which comes out of the 06 war, where the Dahiya section of Beirut, which is the section that is being massively bombed by Israel right now, horrifyingly bombed by Israel right now, that occurred in 06. And that codified in Israeli military doctrine that civilian targets are military targets, that the destruction, the killing, the suffering of civilians is an end of in and of itself. So this is what the Israeli public is looking at in the possibilities of their future. And then you have internal Israeli tensions. You have a desire by many in Israel. This is your chance to take Judea and Samaria, to take the West Bank, to take East Jerusalem, to annex them. There are many reports that Donald Trump has already agreed to this, that in exchange for Israeli lobby money, primarily from Miriam Adelson, that his administration will allow the Israelis to annex the West Bank. It's hard to really see a Democratic administration, though, standing up against that. Under Trump's administration, the Israelis moved their capital, or the Americans moved their embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, violation of all kind of international law standards, just a terrible thing to do. And Biden administration did not move the embassy back. Under the Trump administration, the Israelis annexed the Golan Heights. Clear violation of international law, massive violation of international law. And the Biden administration has done nothing about that, did nothing about that. So it's hard to see that if the Israelis did something as big as annex the West Bank, which many want, which many see as a goal in all this, which many Israelis see as a goal in this, that a Democratic administration, a Harris administration, really do anything. But, you know, so in all this, they also prepare the West Bank for annexation. You've seen, even before October 7th, you know, something like hundreds, over 400, I believe, Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank from January 1st through October 6th of 2023. So before the October 7th attacks, about 50 of them were children. And then since then, you've seen, I think, well above 1,000 killed now in the West Bank, thousands upon thousands, upwards of 10,000 detained on top of the 7 or 8,000 that had already been detained. We all know it's well documented, well established. The torture, the abuse, the sexual violence inflicted systemically on Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. I mean, so all of this, you know, and so the preparation then of the West Bank by the Israelis for annexation, which I think we're beginning to see as they carry out depopulation campaigns in towns and villages, as they start to punish the Palestinian people, destroy their infrastructure, kill their doctors, things like that. You know, this is what the Israeli public is living in, and what type of stability, what type of security can come out of that? Only the security of a fortress Israel, only a security where you have just a society behind massive walls, which essentially is Israel's right now, where there is just violence conducted daily, a mowing of the grass, if you will, having to constantly kill the subhumans, the barbarians outside your wall to protect yourself. That's only possible, of course, if the Americans stay resolved, which I don't see any change in that. But the Americans continue to finance them and support them, protect them, then Fortress Israel can stand. But if you're Israeli, and I didn't even get into the internal Israeli politics of all this, whether it's the settlers, the reactionary religious, the militarist nationalists. I mean, you had a month or two ago, Ronan Bar, who's the head of the Shin Bet, the FBI, the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, say that the biggest danger facing Israel is Jewish terror, is from within, is from their own Jewish settlers. 750,000 armed settlers who believe their purpose is to establish Israel's presence in Palestine because that is God's will. And so when you see 750,000 Israelis turn out to protest Netanyahu, you have 750,000 armed settlers, Israeli settlers, who are watching those people and viewing them as traitors, viewing them as betraying them. And you have to remember, too, those people protesting Netanyahu were not calling for peace. They were calling for a return of the hostages, two things that should be conjoined, but in this case are not. And so you have that tension there. And then all the factors that could precipitate Israel's collapse. You know, I've lost count, Nima, of the amount of retired Israeli generals I've read who have said, we are eating ourselves alive. We are causing our own collapse. So if you're an Israeli and you're looking at this, either you believe this is part of destiny, this is part of the big hand movement of history, this is part of both your modern and biblical history and as an Israeli Jew, or you say this is madness and I got to get out of here. And we have seen that with high numbers of Israelis leaving Israel, not as high as some people claim, but certainly still a depopulation of what you would call the secular Israelis, and most prominently, many Israelis who are well-educated and who work in the tech sector of Israel, which is the backbone of their, one of the backbones of their economy, they are choosing to leave Israel. And it's understandable why. That, again, another very long explanation, but I appreciate the ability to be long-winded here. And I appreciate everyone who listens through this as well.
And the other thing, Matt, with the conflict in Ukraine, we saw that the United States didn't change its policy toward Russia until we have the situation that you know what's going on there. And right now, Russia is not interested in negotiations. They're talking about it right now. And with the and comparing that with what's going on in the Middle East, the way that the new government in Iran is interested to talk with Washington. And the way two assassinations that they were hitting the new government, in my opinion, to not letting them to talk with Washington on the part of Israelis. And right now, Matt, there are some rumors that Iran is reconsidering its nuclear doctrine. Yeah. And it seems that everything is getting out of the hand and nobody seems to care what's going on. Where is diplomacy and who? Because every time, if you just let Netanyahu does what he wants to do, and we've learned that the Israeli defense minister, he's going to be Gallant, going to be in Washington on Wednesday, on October 9th. And in your opinion, are they going to talk about these issues? Are they going to have some sort of seriousness in their talk with Gallant, with anybody from Israel? That Middle East needs peace. And through peace, you can achieve security of Israel. It's not through wars and making new wars, making new fronts. As we know that the Biden administration is not interested in having any sort of major war in the Middle East. And I simply don't see any of these candidates, even Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, being interested in having a major war in the Middle East. How do you find it?
Well, you know, first of all, these people in Washington, D.C., again, they are in a bubble. They are the product. What they know, what they understand, what they are told is the product of decades of a military-industrial complex being able to determine a militarized foreign policy of the United States because we have a legalized bribery system here. So no one in Washington, D.C. is in any official capacity. There are a few outliers, but they never amount to much. And usually what they offer is simply just gestures, or they're notable for being an outlier, and that's it. Bernie Sanders comes to mind. But for the most part, the totality of Washington, D.C. is in agreement with the military and industrial complex, with the American empire overall. And so everything they know, everything they understand, everything they can conceive are all within those limits. So the idea of negotiations providing a pathway to security and stability, the recognition and adherence to international law providing a pathway to security and stability, the addressing of legitimate grievances, the hearing, let alone the addressing of grievances, is just something that is not understood. It comes across as gibberish. It's a foreign language to them. It's not serious. That, I think, I think if people in Washington, D.C., and this applies to both parties, and it applies to the executive and the legislative, it applies to the institutions, whether they be the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, the National Security Council, the think tanks, the academic centers of this, so the universities, even those outside of D.C., like Stanford or Columbia, Harvard, our conversation is not serious. This is not serious. Any of the work you do, Nima, is not serious. My work is not serious, because in one way they are correct, that we don't fall within the parameters of what is possible. We don't fall within the practical realities of the American empire. So this idea that negotiation with your adversary can lead to great benefit to both you and them is impossible, because the whole construct is a zero-sum construct. And if you bring up to them, well, look, in the past year, again, 251 hostages, you know, anyone who doesn't, their heart doesn't break for those families, you know, but 251 of those hostages, 117 have been returned, 8 of them by Israeli military action that probably killed at least as many hostages as were freed, and scores, hundreds, war crimes in order to committed atrocities in order to free them. Okay, so 8 out of the 117 have been returned. How are the other returned? How are the nearly 110, 109 returned? They were returned through negotiations, through talks, through diplomacy. And if you wanted the others back, that's how you would do it. But that type of thing, diplomacy, is forbidden in Washington, D.C. Diplomacy is only valid if it leads to a win in a zero-sum game. Diplomacy is only valid if it is you're dressing your the fabric you put on your Trojan horse for war. That is the only thing, right? So this idea that we are going to say we want a ceasefire, we're going to say we want negotiations, but what we really want is war. But this gives us now the protection. This is preemptive messaging, a preemptive defensive narrative that we tried for peace, but you know, and the fact is that they wouldn't. I mean, my own examples in Afghanistan, talk about Iraq as well too, but in Afghanistan, where the talk to the Taliban wanted to talk from the time we invaded up until probably around 2013 or maybe 2012, they were willing to talk. At that point, it was clear they were winning and they were only going to talk to us on their terms, which is what they did under the Trump administration. But during that time, that 10-year period of time, we could have talked to them. There are always preconditions on us, on our talking to the Taliban. And those preconditions were essentially terms of surrender for the Taliban. Yeah, but it gives the Americans the out, right? The excuse. We offered them and they said no. And that's what you see even today with Israel and the Palestinians. New York Times yesterday, big story, or maybe it was 2 days ago, about how Hamas is rejecting the ceasefire terms. And I mean, it's just completely, you're upside down on this. You think you're taking crazy pills. What are you seeing? What? You know, I mean, Hamas has accepted ceasefire terms a number of times. They accepted the terms offered in May. They accepted them in July. In August, they were going to accept, they would have accepted them again. Every time the Israelis said no, they moved the terms of the negotiations, and the Americans went along with it. Oftentimes, the American diplomacy in this has been just to protect American interests. So back in August, when Blinken is in Israel and he is speaking quite dramatically and quite forcibly how a deal is at hand, the Israelis have agreed to it. We just need Hamas to agree to it. And the Israelis come out and they say, what is he talking about? He's lying. Blinken's lying about this. And then some of the Israelis, which is, I think, what you and I talked about at the time, said this is all just a stunt. This is all just a PR stunt because the Democratic Party National Convention is next week. And what they want is to have an agreement so that Harris can announce it at the convention, or at least have some of the pressure taken off of her. There's no interest in an actual deal that would stop the genocide. No. I mean, so these people, the only way they can view these types of things is if there is a benefit to themselves or to their institutions. And of course, you have a militarized foreign policy that is the backbone of the American empire. This stands on a foundation of the corporate interests. not just the military-industrial complex, but the banks, the fossil fuel companies, the tech companies, and so forth. And, you know, so you have this these twin drivers of American foreign policy that are greed, or that are megalomania and corporate greed. And then on top of that, to make it this even more, to make what's occurring with Israel even more pronounced, Israel, through its lobby here in the United States, has an extreme effect, a controlling effect on American decision-making with regards to the Middle East. And we've seen this for decades. So you already have an American empire predisposed to supporting Israel against Palestine, because this is historically what the empire would do. Remember, we inherited the British Empire's interests in the region when we assumed their role in the world. And part of that was Israel and Palestine. So we're not, the empire is not going to give up on that. It wants to see it push further. And of course, anyone who pushes against the empire is the empire's enemy. And that's been Iran for four decades. But then on top of that, you have this control, this ability for the Israeli lobby to put a gun to the head of the Democratic National Party, the Democratic Party, over this last year. In effect, saying, you know, you see the Harris campaign willing to give up millions of votes, possibly lose the election, in order to stay on the good side of the Israeli lobby. I mean, so you roll that together, you know, and I think you get an understanding of why there is no chance for diplomacy here, why there is no ability for those in Washington, D.C., within the empire, to conceive of a negotiated settlement, of a dialogue, if you will, that would lead to security and stability. Because it's just not allowed. It's forbidden. It doesn't meet the ground interests of the American empire. And it certainly doesn't meet the acute political interests of staying in the good graces of the Israel lobby. And so we will not see that. And we will see this open-ended war and this belief that conflict with Iran, with war with Iran, could be managed and dialed back as needed. And God help us when this all comes to play, which, you know, as we know, Nima, we're recording this now at 2:30 in the afternoon on Monday, you know, October 7th, and we get off of this call with each other and we turn on the television and there could be this regional war. It's already been a regional war, but I think people know what I mean. The expansion of it, the blowing up of it, that we have been fearing. My best guess, though, is that the Americans are going to do everything they can to hold the Israelis off until after the elections. Reports this week in Jerusalem Post that the Americans are offering all types of inducements and goodies to the Israelis if they don't attack Iran in any way that's going to jeopardize the American elections before the elections are over. And when I say that, I primarily mean do something that sparks such a massive Iranian retaliation that the U.S. has to come in. But also, most importantly, is the idea that it causes economic problems worldwide, that there's an oil shock. Right. The Israelis bomb the Iranian oil facilities. The Iranians close the Straits of Hormuz. And then oil goes to, gasoline in the U.S. goes to more than $8 a gallon. And Harris doesn't win in November. The time is shortening. It's less than a month now. And I think the White House just wants to get through that.
Yeah. Recently, Macron was talking about putting an arms embargo on Israel. And here is what Netanyahu said responding him.
I have a message for President Macron. Today, Israel is defending itself on seven fronts against the enemies of civilization. We're fighting in Gaza against Hamas, those savages who murdered, raped, beheaded, and burned our people on October 7th. We're fighting in Lebanon against Hezbollah, the most heavily armed terror organization in the world, which was planning an even greater massacre than October 7th on our northern border, and that has rocketed Israeli towns and cities for nearly a year. We're fighting against the Houthis in Yemen and the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria that together have launched hundreds of drones and missile attacks against Israel. We're fighting against terrorists in Judea and Samaria who are trying to murder civilians in the heart of our cities. And we're fighting against Iran, which last week fired over 200 ballistic missiles directly at Israel, and which stands behind the seven-front war against Israel. As Israel fights the forces of barbarism led by Iran, all civilized countries should be standing firmly by Israel's side. Yet President Macron and some other Western leaders are now calling for an arms embargo against Israel. Shame on them. Is Iran imposing an arms embargo on Hezbollah, on the Houthis, on Hamas, and on its other proxies? Of course not. The axis of terror stands together. But countries who supposedly oppose this terror axis call for an arms embargo on Israel. What a disgrace. Well, let me tell you this. Israel will win with or without their support. But their shame will continue long after the war is won.
Yeah. Matt, when you look at, when you hear what he's talking about, it seems that we are living in two different situations, with two different minds. He's talking about something. First of all, he's talking about many wars, that seven fronts of this conflict against Israel. And he, in Gaza, he wasn't successful, as you mentioned, right now with Hezbollah. And he started that they attacked us, beheaded children. And he goes on and making new narratives, making new rhetorics. And he thinks that he can inject these type of narratives to each and everybody hearing him. How do you find it? Is he totally connected with reality, or he's thinking that he can manipulate everybody's mind in terms of to accept what he's talking about?
I think he I think he understands. Look, Netanyahu is very capable. Every time, and I mean, we've known this guy for decades. Every time we think he's gone, he comes back. There's arguments as to how much of a true believer in Zionism he is, how much of a true believer in his faith he actually is. There's arguments back and forth on that. His dedication to the Zionist cause, though, should be well understood, that it's not just his political survival, which of course is of importance to him, and many commentators will say it's his most important thing, and I don't really disagree with them on that, but also too, right alongside that is his view of Israel in the world, his view of Israel in the Middle East, his view of Israel historically, and his role in that, and ensuring its progress forward, and ensuring the continuation of that history, whether it's, again, it comes out from the militarist nationalist side or the reactionary religious side, the endpoints are the same. It's the expansion of greater Israel. It's the construction, the continuation, the building of fortress Israel. It's the punishment of your enemies, right? I mean, so you can see how all that rolls up. What Netanyahu is very good about is on narrative control. And he's not really speaking to Macron, although we have to make the point that Macron and France did walk back their arms embargo, as I understand it, that there's not going to be an arms embargo. Not that the French were providing that many weapons to military assistance to Israel. 98 or 99% of the military assistance to Israel comes from the United States and Germany, about 70% from the United States, about 28 or so percent from Germany. Although the Germans supposedly have cut that back, actually, in this past year, which is a bigger story than people have been talking about. And it can show that the strengths of domestic political pressure on a government, something that here in the United States, the establishment, the elites, the system have been very competent in insulating our government from, right? The idea that people on the streets are going to change policy, it's just not the case anymore. Maybe it was in the 60s and 70s, but the way that our system is insulated with money, those movements don't have the political effect they need to. It is also something to do with not having a viable political arm that is part of that political body, that part of those movements. But what Netanyahu is very good about is the narrative, and speaking particularly to his people, to his constituency, to keep the narrative going, to keep it afloat, to repair where it's been hurt. And, you know, he talks very convincingly and very strongly, very passionately. And this dovetails with the messages in the United States, which is the most important part of the Israeli information operations, you know, as well as to the Israeli public. So this idea that we're under attack from seven fronts. You will hear that message today, October 7th, throughout American media, whether it's American media commentators, whether it's contributors, whether it is retired generals, most especially, though, from American politicians themselves. If you go and you look on Twitter, on X, and look at what members of the House of Representatives and the Senate are posting, whether they're Democrat or Republican, they echo that. They echo, of course, the lamentation over October 7th, but then also, too, Israel is under attack on seven different fronts. It's enemies. It's surrounded. We have to help our strongest ally. We have to defend the only democracy in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and what they're always trying to do, Nima, this gets back to what I said earlier about within the bubble of the empire, within what's allowed to be spoken in Washington, D.C., in American corporate media, the actual hard truth of this. What is this all about? This is about the occupation of Palestine. This is about the ethnic cleansing that began more than 100 years ago. This goes back to the Zionist Congress in 1897, to the 1917 Balfour Declaration, to the Brits in the 1930s saying our purpose here in Palestine is to establish a loyal Jewish Ulster in the midst of a potentially hostile sea of Arabs. I mean, like the history of this is clear. The context should be clear. And what is almost always forbidden to be spoken about is that there is a peace offer on the table from the Arab states and from the Palestinians, the Arab Peace Initiative. It's been around for decades now, for two decades now. It is simple. It calls for the creation of a Palestinian state. If you have that based upon 1967 borders and you a true Palestinian state, not these things that the Americans and the Israelis hawk. You'll hear Hillary Clinton, I'm sure she's talking somewhere right now about this, about how the Israelis and the Americans offered the Palestinians a peace plan, offered their own state, but the Palestinians said no, they'd rather have war. Their idea of a Palestinian state was essentially a state without control of its borders, a state with no police, with no military, a state with no airport, no seaport, a state with no ability to control their trade outside their borders, a state that wasn't even in control of their own resources. Under that plan put forward by that Clinton talks about all the time, the Israelis would have controlled about 80% of the water in the West Bank. I mean, so that's the lies, the gaslighting, the fabrications that are presented to hide from the reality that there is an answer here. It's a Palestinian state based on 1967 borders. A true state, one that's able to provide its own security, allows for its own trade, people are allowed to travel freely, is not essentially an occupied state as any plan that comes from Israeli Americans continually have it as. That is the answer. And it's clear and nothing more needs to be said about it. But you see Netanyahu, you see Clinton, you see these others who are propagating Greater Israel, propagating the Zionist cause, propagating Fortress Israel, and of course the American Empire will refuse to acknowledge it, and they will do everything they can to provide a narrative that runs contrary to it. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, to talk with you.
Hey, thank you so much, Nima. I appreciate it.